Now we're holding on page 82 in Bava Metzia, the paragraph labeled Daf Yud Zayin. So the end of us Nun Hey. The subject of this parak is various dinim involving upstairs and downstairs neighbors, which is therefore kind of an introduction to the next Masech to Bava Basra, which starts talking about dinim of neighbors in its first and second prokim primarily. So you have cases where there was a two-story house and it collapsed, and different dinim about what we do as far as who gets what of the debris that they can use to rebuild the house, and different dinim involving upstairs and downstairs neighbors. So one of them the Gemara discusses is in what situations are there? Suppose, for example, that there is water leaking from the upstairs apartment to the downstairs one, then who is responsible to fix it? We could say that the upstairs one is responsible to make sure that he doesn't pour water. On the other hand, the other way of looking at it is it's leaking through the plaster. Maybe the downstairs neighbor should be the one who has to fix his ceiling so that the water doesn't get in. So the Gemara tells, Hanu Beitre, there were two people, Dahabu Dairi Chadiloi, Bechad Patoi, there were two people living, one upstairs and one downstairs. If Chisma Ziva, the plaster had gotten broken, the ceiling between the first and second floor was basically intact, but there were cracks in it, so that Kimoshi Maya Eloi went upstairs when they would wash their hands or otherwise wash with water, and it would leak onto the, and it would get onto the floor, as that water would go, Maski Vitatoi, and damage things downstairs, because the water would leak through, the water would leak through the cracks. Rashi points out, we're not talking about over here of a landlord and a tenant. We're talking about each of them. It's like nowadays in a condo or something. Each one owns his own apartment. Mimasakin, the question is then who is responsible to fix it? Rav Chiya Ba'aba, Omar Al-Eliya Masakin. So Rav Chiya Ba'aba says it's the responsibility of the upstairs neighbor to fix it, because it's his water that's running downstairs and causing damage. Rabbi Loi, in the name of Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef, says that it's the downstairs one who has to fix it, because basically, if he wants to make sure that the water doesn't drip on his head and on his furniture and whatever, and the cracks are in his plaster, again, Mela, if the ceiling itself was caving in, then the upstairs one would have to fix it, if nothing else, so he has a floor to be able to walk on. But like this, he could say, basically, it's not my problem, the plaster on your side is cracked. You don't want water coming into your house. You make sure to fix the plaster, and it shouldn't be my responsibility. The Gemara does go on to mention it depends. For example, is it that as soon as they pour the water upstairs, it immediately leaks downstairs? Then that's different. That would be the equivalent of one person standing in his property and shooting arrows into the other ones and saying, "Yeah, but it's in my property." Obviously, you can't get away with that. What we're talking about over here is where the water goes on the floor, it gets absorbed into the floor, and later on it leaks in through the cracks to the downstairs apartment. So, okay, so you have a machlokes, which one has to fix it? The simon to remember, so we have Rav Chiya Ba'aba saying one thing, and Rav Chiya Bar Yosef saying the other thing, with the second one being Rabbi Loi, in the name of Rav Chiya Bar Yosef, how do you remember which one is which? The simon to remember it is the expression in the pasuk, the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma. Yosef was brought down to Mitzrayim. So brought down, that helps us remember that it's Rav Chiya Bar Yosef who says that it's the one who's down, the downstairs neighbor, who has to fix it if he wants to avoid the hezek. You have such kinds of things in Bava Basra. There's something about that. For example, sometimes we have a concept, ala mazik lahayuchat asatzmoi. Sometimes you have, there are certain things you, who are potentially going to be causing a hezek, are responsible to remove your hezek and make sure it doesn't damage the other guy, versus sometimes we say, ala mizik lahayuchat asatzmoi. Sometimes there are things that I'm perfectly entitled to do in my reshus, and if they have side effects on you, then you would be responsible to make sure that those side effects don't happen. So in a similar vein over here, Rav Chiya Bar Abba and Rav Chiya Bar Yosef are arguing. What's the din in this case?
Who's the one that says the top one is responsible?
So the top one is Rav Chiya Bar Abba. The bottom one is Rav Chiya Bar Yosef. So we remember Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma. Yosef was brought down to Mitzrayim. So So a boyne buns over here at the bottom of the page the idea would be, in other words, the symbolism of it is that just like with Yosef and his brothers, for example, his brothers felt that they were above him and they didn't feel they need to care about him and whatever. And whereas Yosef was on the bottom and he had to work hard to get himself out of that and to bring himself to work hard for Potiphar and later on later on in the jail where Hashem gave him chesed and so on and so forth. So therefore he says that's the connection with this Yosef Hora Mitzrayim. In other words, that if a person is down below over here, like the downstairs neighbors, don't just give up. Realize, in other words, you have what to do, you have what to fix up. Various Mephoshim talk about symbolisms of it. Also represents, for example, Ben Yehoyada over here talks about it, symbolizes that there's two areas of the body that have a bris. It's talked about in a lot of places, in Zohar, and Sifrei Kabbalah, and Chassidus, there's a bris on the tongue, and then there's a bris lower down in the body, in the male organ. And there's a connection between them. It talks about, in many places, the one that a pagam in one tends to lead to a pagam in the other. So now the question is, if a person has a problem with those, which one does he have to work on fixing first? So then you have this machlokas over here in the Gemara, symbolizing is that question, and the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma is Yosef, we know, passed a test, a very difficult test with Eishes Potiphar, involving the bris milah, and for that we're saying that Hurad Mitzrayma, he's the one who worked extra hard on that, on being sacked in that, and that's a message for us to also be able to work on, to give us the koyach to work on the same thing.
Work on both at the same time,
but if you have to pick, it may be hard for a person to work on both at the same time. Then we're saying that we have over here the example of Yosef. And there's different other ideas and symbolisms brought about this, as far as it also represents, for example, the mind and the motion and the midas, for example. Again, if a person has both of those to work on, which one is the primary one to work on? And the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayim, actually, he worked on both of them. He gave an asinas koyach to the Jewish people in Mitzrayim and to the Jewish people for all time to be able to pass and to be successful in both of those things. The last Mishnah of the Masechta says, Shtei Ginis Zu Agavzu, two gardens that are one above the other. So in other words, you have, it can be either on a slope or more likely, and this is the way Mephoshim seem to understand, is you have, it's like there's terraces. You have a garden up above, then you have a vertical wall of a couple of feet tall or whatever, and then below it, below the vertical wall, you have another garden. By Yerek Bentayim, and there are vegetables growing on the wall between them. So who those vegetables belong to? They're not in either one's rishus, so what do we do with them? Reb Meir and Mishal Elyon, Reb Meir says they belong to the one who owns the garden on top. Reb Yehuda and Mishal Tachton, Reb Yehuda says they belong to the one who has the bottom garden. What's the logic? The Mishnah continues. Amar Reb Meir, Im Yitzeh Elyon, Lika Chasafarei, after all, the top one, if he wanted to remove his dirt, Ein Kan Yerek, there'd be no vegetables growing over here. They're growing out of the wall, which forms the bed of his garden. So if he decided one day to dig up his garden and make it on the same level as the garden below, then there'd be no vegetables growing there. Therefore, it should belong to him. Amr of Yehuda, on the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says, the other way around, and vice versa, if the one with the lower garden wanted to fill up his garden, if he wanted to fill it up with dirt and make it equal and level to the top one, also in Kanyerek, then there wouldn't be any vegetables here either. So therefore, you have more reason to say that the existence of those vegetables depends on him, depends on the lower one. Amr of Meir, so the Meir says, fine, I hear what you're saying, Rabbi Yehuda, but me'achas shneim yecholim limchas zal zeh, but given that each one of them is able to prevent the other one, each one is able to do something to prevent these vegetables from growing, royin mehechen yerech zechai, let's have a look and see where is this vegetable actually living from. Where is it rooted in? Where is it getting its nourishment in? From the dirt, from the top one. Therefore, says Rabbi Meir, you have very good reason, after all, not just the fact that he could conceivably remove the dirt and it wouldn't be there, true, because then you could say, the other way around, the bottom one could fill up his with dirt, but the fact is, right now it's rooted in the dirt of the top one, and therefore that's a better reason to give it to him. Reb Shimon Omer. Reb Shimon says another, on a so, sort of an in-between kind of thing. Any part of those vegetables, which the one up above is able to stretch out his hand, the little, and be able to take it, then that belongs to him. The rest belongs to the one on bottom. So the basic reason that many Mephoshim explain, the basic reason is, Tosfos discusses it, other Mephoshim discuss, is basically Reb Shimon is taking the view, really Reb Meir has a point, it ought to belong to the top one. However, it would be a gnai for him, it would be an embarrassing thing for him to say, you know, we're arguing over these vegetables, and then I'm going to have to go down to you, Mr. Downstairs Neighbor, and say, can I please come into your garden to pick the rest of these vegetables? So therefore, basically, he's maskier whatever he can't pick. So whatever he's able to reach out from his side and pick, then fine, he'll take it for himself based on what the mayor said. From the top one, but anything that he can't reach, shaltachta, and then he's willing to be masker to the bottom one rather than have to embarrass himself and go to the downstairs one and ask him for permission to go into his garden and pick them. That's points of Rashi and Tosfos and so forth. Then Ramban discusses another possibility that ever brings it in a hadron on this Masechta from Toshin Chavav. It never talks about the idea that it never brings over there, and something that the Ramban says on it, but on the contrary, Reb Shimon may be following basically Reb Yehuda's opinion, that Reb Yehuda is saying that it belongs to the down, that it belongs to the one on bottom, so therefore some of it will belong to the bottom, but on the other hand, it is true, it is also growing from the dirt of the top one, and therefore the top one has a certain right to it as well, and therefore whatever he can pick, he's able to take. So we'll talk about in a minute. Actually, there's an interesting deep explanation on this from the Tzemach that seems to be from the Tzemach Tzedek, and it's printed in Ora Torah. Although there's a footnote over there from the Rebbe that based on the style, it may not be from the Tzemach Tzedek. It may actually be from someone else. And in fact, maybe it's one of the sons of the Tzemach Tzedek who had their own style. It's also brought in some Sfarim that explanation may be from Rabbi Yisroel Volodniker. But we'll get to it in a minute after we do the Gemara. So actually, in that hadron, then the Rebbe points out that the idea is that the idea is, in other words, according to the Ramban's explanation of it, the vote is Rabbi Yehuda would say, Faket, the bottom one is willing to be maskir most of it to the, whatever the top one can reach. Since he can reach over there, Yodeh Magastrom, he's able to reach it, then he's willing to be maskir it to them. And after all, the guy up above figures it's basically his because he can fix it to himself. It's true. Let him take it. If I do start telling you, you know what, you can't reach down into my garden, then yeah, Yitzolos Afare, he'll take away his dirt, and then there won't be any vegetables there at all. So the Ramban learns that Shimon is basically following Rabbi Yehuda's Svara. In that hadron, the Rebbe talks about the idea that based on that way of looking at it, and based on also how the Rambam formulates the relevant halachas, we can find a connection between this and the beginning of the Masechta, Shnayim Ochsim Batalis, where two people are arguing about ownership of a talis, and there you don't have this consideration of Likach HaSafore and Lamale HaSafore, and the result is they divide it between them, as opposed to over here, they don't divide it 50-50. It depends on how much each one can reach. Okay. Anyway, the Gemara says, Omer Ephraim Safra, Talmidei Shel Reish Lakish, Mishum Reish Lakish, Ephraim Safra, that was his name, he was a surfer, said, who's a Talmud of Reish Lakish, and he says in the name of Reish Lakish, Halacha K'Reb Shimon, that the Halacha is like Reb Shimon of our Mishnah, that again, whatever part of the vegetables, the one on top, is able to reach, he gets to keep, and the rest goes to the bottom one, either because as Rashi and Tosfos say, because he's master it to the bottom one, or as the Ramban says the other way around, because the bottom one is maskir most of it to the top one. Amrua kameh de Shabur Malka. They told over this statement to Shabur Malka. Now, Shabur Malka can have a double meaning. There was a king of Persia, there were a couple of kings of Persia, actually, named Shabur. So then it would mean Parshat the king of Persia. Rashi points out that we find in a few places in Shas that he was expert in dinim. We find at the end of Avodah Zarah, notably, there's a story over there where there were two Jews in front of him, and he wanted to cut a slice of esrog. He stuck a knife in the ground to kasher it, and then he cut a slice of esrog and gave to Mal Yehuda, showing that he's familiar with the dinim, that his knives are treif, but that you can stick them in hard ground in order to kasher them, in order to cut cold foods. So we find here and there in Shas that he was Baki and Dinim. So this would be one of them that told him over the statement of Reb Shimon. Omalehu, he says to them, Apirya Namtiya Reb Shimon, or grace, or favor should be given to Reb Shimon. In other words, I approve, I like very much this idea that Reb Shimon said, and I approve of it and I praise it. Now that's one explanation. Rashi gives a second explanation. Sometimes we find in Shas that Shmuel, the Amora, is called Shabur Malka, because as much as Shabur was a king and then of a boss of a dumb ruling over an empire, a Persian empire, Lahavdil, Shmuel, the great Talmud Chacham, the great Amora, was the king in Torah, especially in Dini Mominus, where usually the halacha is like him in Dini Mominus. So Rashi says, some want to explain that Shabur Malka over here, Taka refers to Shmuel. But Rashi says it doesn't work out. What exactly are they telling him? They're telling him Reb Shimon's statements in our Mishnah. They don't need to tell it to him. He's an Amora. He knows what it says in the Mishnah. They're telling him what Ephraim Safra had said, the halacha is like Shmuel. So Shmuel needs Reb Shlokish or his Talmud to tell us that the halacha is like Reb Shimon. He could figure it out himself. So therefore, so better to say that it means the actual Shabur Malka, and yeah, he was an expert in Dinim. Tosfos over here, in fact, refers to that story in Avodah Zarah where we see that he knew about the knife. They talk about this question, how you will have a concept. The Gemara says that you're not supposed to teach Divrei Torah to Goyim. One answer that's given, Maharat Chayes talks about, is Goyim have Shev Mitzvahs Bnei Noyach. One of them is Dinim. They have to set up a justice system. And part of that includes that they need to know Dinim Ominous. In fact, the Ramban in particular holds that when we say that they have a Mitzvah of Dinim, it means basically they have to know our whole Choshen Mishpat. They have to know it and apply it in their legal system, according to Bnei Noach. But even if you say that not, they still have to know the basics of how to run a legal system. So therefore, that kind of thing, they're entitled to teach Shabur. Another explanation is maybe they're not teaching him the halacha per se. They're just telling him almost like an interesting thing about this case over here and what Reb Shimon says. Anaf Yosef discusses over here a symbolism of it that we have Shemayim, Shemayim Lashem, Va'aretz Nosan Livnei Adam. So if you have something in between, Shemayim Va'aretz, then who does it belong to? And now we're saying that it's kind of something in between, that he shows that the Aver, that the heir belongs to Hashem, and therefore he's impressed by that and says our grace and our favor should be extended to Reb Shimon. So for that matter, actually, Eitz Yosef points out, we find there was a later Shabur Malka, as I said, there were a couple of kings of Persia named Shabur Malka. One of them, the Gemara mentions in a few places, his mother was named Ifra Hurmiz, where Ifra also comes from the same Shoda, Shapirian, which means grace and beauty. So therefore, he's the type to, so Ifra Hurmiz, it actually explains in some places, means a beauty of Shadim. So therefore, like he had this kind of thing of chayin, of grace and beauty very much on his mind, and therefore he uses this expression. So now, again, there's this explanation from that's printed in Orat Torah in the name of the Tzemach Tzedek, although it's brought in various Kisvei Yad, and some of them not on the name of the Tzemach Tzedek, but rather in the name of the Zelenniker, that Rebbe points out in a footnote over there, it doesn't seem to exactly match the Tzemach Tzedek style, but in any case, it goes as follows. The Shtei Ginnis represent Gan Eden HaTachton and Gan Eden HaElyon. So there's one place that Tzemach Tzedek talks about, therefore, that this vegetable in between represents the omud. You have like a pillar, so to speak, through which neshamas travel from one to the other. And the question is basically which one it belongs to more. But in this longer explanation in Orat Torah, the explanation is that it's Gan Eden HaTachton, Gan Eden HaElyon. It's also the Nefesh HaLekis and Nefesh HaBahamis. So now the question is, you have Yerek in between. Yerek represents then things of Olam Hazeh. Specifically, we use the name Yerek for it because Yerek means it comes from the word Yorek, which means green, which is like an in-between color. You have the color white, which is Chesed, and then the Nefesh HaLekis, and red, which is the color of the Nefesh HaBahamas, and green is sort of an in-between shade of color between them. So it represents how now a person can take those in-between things and use them for Kedusha, in which case then we take the letters of Yerek and rearrange them to form the word Yoker, which means precious. You've made it into a precious thing for the Eidishter. On the other hand, a person misuses it and eats it for his tivus, then you rearrange the letters yet again, and it becomes Keri, as in Tomas Keri. So that's why the Mishnah picks Yerek, then, according to this explanation, to symbolize this idea of something that's in between, that between the Nefesh Elokis and Nefesh HaBahamas, and each one is claiming ownership of it. So he goes on to explain Rameir, Meloshin Ha'ora, represents the Ha'ora of the Asora Ma'amores on it, and he says, therefore, it basically belongs to the Elyonim by virtue of that. Rabbi Yehuda's name includes with it the name Yudke Vovke, which represents the Amshocha down here Lamata. Therefore, he focuses on Morshel Tachton, it's up to us, Tachtonim, to elevate it and use it for Kedusha. He makes another point over there that it's also Meloshin Hoida, as in, where you see you have the Loshin Hoida is brought in Chassidus when a person doesn't know, when a person doesn't understand, but he acknowledges anyway, that's called Hoidah. So therefore, you're talking about a person who may not understand the concept that Lakus keeps, that the Ur Laki keeps everything going, but nevertheless, he's Moida to it. So that's also Rabbi Yehuda. So he's the Tachton. And the point is, in other words, with what can a person motivate himself to make sure that this Yerek becomes Yoker rather than Keri? So the mayor looks at it from the point of view, look at it, in Yirtza Elyon, look at Chasafora. If the Eivishter wanted to take away his Ur Laki, there would be no Yerek over here. Therefore, that should motivate you that you want to use it for Kedusha. Rabbi Yehuda looks at it from the point of view. If you wanted to fill up your garden with earth, meaning if you wanted to just get sunken into your Tivus, then there also ain't Kan Yerek. There's no point for the Eivishter creating this thing in the first place. And the mayor says, after all, a person has to motivate himself and think, where does the chayus of this come from? It comes from Lamaila, therefore he has a responsibility to make sure that it is able to go Lamaila and not drag down Lamata. And then Reb Shimon comes and says that Reb Shimon, Meloshin Shvia, a person can at least derher, a person can perceive, and of course to the extent that he can recognize that he has work to do with this to make sure that it belongs to the Elyon, that the Eibishter will help him out with what he can, and the rest of it is up to him to accomplish. And then when we say that they inform this to Shabur Malka before King Shabur, so he explains at the end of it there, Shabur Malka represents the concept of Shvira Sakelin. And Kameh means before. So we're talking about a level of Seder Shnalshos before Shvira Sakelin even. So from that point of view, yes, a person can realize and motivate himself to use this for the right purpose, a period, and the result is there would be peiros of it that he will be able to accomplish, and he'll be able to accomplish peiros in his avodah, a period namti elirab shimon. So that's the explanation, the kikser. Hadron aloch masecht above matzia. Turning now to Baba Basra, turn ahead of page or two, we have Chidush HaGoinim over here, and then after that, those who are using the English one, I guess we'll have to switch volumes at this point. Okay. Beginning of Masechta Baba Basra talks about people where two partners want to divide up a chotzer and they want to build a wall in between so each of them has privacy. So the Mishnah talks about exactly how that wall has to be constructed and how wide it has to be depending on different construction materials, etc. So now you have like this. The Mishnah mentions that if the wall is made out of gvil, which is unhewn stones, then the width of the wall should be 6 tefachim. And each one of them will provide 3 tefachim of space from out of their chotzer towards it. So
unused stones.
In other words, you can have stones that are squared off and cut and then cut and shaped. Those you don't need as much room. Those the Gemara says 5. Those the Mishnah says 5 tefachim is enough. 2.5 from each one of them. But if they're unhewn, if they have rough edges, and they're going to be sticking out. They're going to be put into a wall, but then you have edges of them that stick out on the two sides, and you need an extra kefach to accommodate that. So eventually, the Gemara gets into the following question: in the first Beis Hamikdash, between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodashim, there was a wall 1 amma thick that separated them. There was a wall 1 amma thick. There was a doorway in that wall which was covered with a parochas, but for the most part, the demarcation between them was a wall. Now, in the second Beis HaMikdash, instead of a wall, there were 2 paroichasin, 1 amma apart. The Gemara explains in Yuma, the reason was because they had a suffix. In the first Beis HaMikdash, they had 40 ammas of space for the Kodesh, then this amma of wall, and then 20 ammas for the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In the second Beis HaMikdash, as the Gemara explains over here, as we'll talk about in a second, they were not able to build a wall. So now, if we're going to only have a paroichas there, like they have in the Mishkan, the question is, which side is that one amma supposed to be assigned to? Is it part of the 40 ammas of the Kodesh, or is it part of the 20 ammas of the Kodesh HaKadoshim? So therefore, they had two parochas in, one amma apart, with that amma being called amma traxin. That amma is like an in-between thing. When the Kohen Gadol would go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Mishnah describes in Yoma, he would go through one parochas, walk between them, walk the length between them, and then come out the other side. So the Gemara discusses why they needed parochas in, why they couldn't build a wall. And the reason is, the Gemara explains because the first floor, the ground floor of the Kodesh was taller in the second Beis Hamikdash than it was in the first. In the first Beis Hamikdash, the ground floor was 30 amas tall. And the Gemara says a wall, one amma thick, and 30 amas tall is fine, that'll be stable and it will stand. The second Beis Hamikdash, though, the first floor was 40 amas tall, as the Gemara is going to now bring a pasuk that expresses that point. A 40 amma tall wall, only one amma thick, is not going to be stable. It would collapse. And the Gemara goes on to talk about why they couldn't build it. Part wall and part parochas, whatever. The point is that the Gemara establishes they couldn't, and therefore, of necessity, they needed parochas in rather than a wall there. So where do we see that the second Beis Hamikdash in that sense was taller than the first? So the pasuk says, the Navi says to the Haggai, when he's urging the Jewish people to continue building the second Beis Hamikdash. Now, you know, they had come back from Babel, and when Kodesh proclaimed that they can rebuild the Beis Hamikdash, 42,000 and some Jews came from Babel. They started the work. Then the Kusim and other Goyim there got involved and mastered on them and claimed that no, they're going to rebel again, et cetera, and Kodesh rescinded the permission, and it remained suspended that permission throughout the rest of the life of Kodesh and afterwards 14 years of Ahasuerus. We know famously Ahasuerus tells Esther ad Chatzi HaMalchus, and the Gemara says that it means you can ask for anything except the Beis Hamikdash because that'll split apart my kingdom. And eventually Ahasuerus dropped dead and his son Daryavash took over in the second year of Daryavash. The Nevi'im Chagai, Ischari, and Malachi are telling the Jewish people it's time to restart the rebuilding. Don't worry about royal permission, just do it. They start. The local Persian governor, a fellow named Tachnai, comes along and says, what's going on over here? They tell him, we're building the Beis Hamikdash. He writes to Daryavash, do they actually have permission to do that? Daryavash has a search made, and they find Kodesh's original proclamation, and Daryavash says, then in that case, we're going to allow it to go ahead.
Daryavash was
Esther and Ahasuerus' son, right. We can well assume, and some people write as much, that probably Esther and Mordechai are probably working behind the scenes there in the palace to get Daryavash to agree.
She died.
It was 14 years king, and then he died, you know.
How long? 40?
14 years. I don't know if he was old or not.
He died. Doesn't seem
like he died. Maybe he drank himself to death. Anyway.
He wasn't killed or anything.
No, not that I know of. Okay, in any case, so the Navi Chagai, when he's telling the Jewish people to build the Beis Hamikdash, he says, Godo yikvoit abayis hazeh ha'achren min orishon. This later Beis Hamikdash, the glory of it will be greater than the first one. Now, what does that mean? Rav Shmuel, v'amri lo Rabbi Lozer, Rabbi Yechanan, so Rav and Shmuel, or some say Rabbi Lozer and Rabbi Yechanan, argue what that means. Chad Amar b'binyan, one says in the construction, in the structure of it, that the second one was taller, as we just said. Now, Rashi over here says that it was 100 amas tall. Now, that is true. The entire Heichal was indeed 100 amas tall. However, here we're focusing on the first floor, and it was actually 40 amas tall. So there's a note over here, there's a footnote, bringing from Tosfos Yom Tov, that maybe Rashi had written the letter Mem, which means 40, and somebody mistakenly expanded it to the word Meo, which means 100. So the first floor, the ground floor of the second Beis Hamikdash was 40 amas tall, whereas in the first Beis Hamikdash it was 30 amas tall. So in that sense, it was greater, it was bigger in construction. V'chadam b'shanim, the other one says in years, the first Beis Hamikdash stood 410 years, the second one 420. And the Gemara points out both are correct. V'isalaha, both of them are correct. It was taller and it lasted longer. And therefore, the Gemara explains again that they couldn't make a wall 40 amas tall and only one amma thick and have it be stable. It wouldn't. It would collapse, and therefore they had parochas in instead. By the way, it talks about Yechezkel describes in the third Beis Hamikdash, Shivonim Head of Yemenu, that that wall will be 2 amas thick. So now this third Beis Hamikdash, he doesn't explicitly say in Pesukim how tall the third Beis Hamikdash, the Heichal, is going to be. Rashi there learns it's going to be 100 amas, just like the second one. The Malbim learns it's going to be much, much taller than that. But whatever the case, when the wall is 2 amas thick, then it will be able to be much taller, and there won't be a problem. It'll be stable, especially with modern construction techniques. They can make it, Mestama, even a lot taller. But therefore, so they'll be able to go back to having a wall like they had in the first Beis Hamikdash.
So was the second one?
Second one was saying the ground floor was 40 amas.
And this third
the third one would say there's a so Yechezkel doesn't describe the, he doesn't say explicitly how tall it is. He describes the floor. He describes the floor plan of the Heichel. He describes the toyim, the little side chambers around it. He doesn't explicitly say the height. He just says you have the Loshen HaPasuk over there. Ve'ra'isti labayis goyva saviv saviv. He says I saw a height all around of the house of the Heichel. Rashi explains. It's Rashi on the Pasuk explains there that it means it's going to be 100 amos like the second Beis Hamikdash.
But not 2 amos. What was, I think you said something 2 amos.
40 amos ground floor, 100 amos total.
That's the second
or the second Beis Hamikdash, and Rashi explains also the third.
And the third also.
The third also, Rashi explains, will be the same height. Malbim learns it'll be much, much taller, yeah. When we use the expression of Yehu Ha'achron, by the way, about the second Beis Hamikdash, is an interesting one. Ha'achron usually means the last one. But it obviously doesn't mean that, because the second Beis Hamikdash wasn't the last one. There's still a third Beis Hamikdash to yet be built. So the simple idea is, one idea is that the Navi is telling them this could be the last one if you're Zoicha. The idea was supposed to be, after all, that the one that Yechezkel had said Nevuah on a few decades before should have been the one that they built when they come from Golas Babel, had they been Zoicha. But they weren't, and therefore they instead they built the second one, which eventually was destroyed. So therefore he's telling them Ha'achron, in the sense, this could be the last one if you live up to it. But since it didn't, then also the fact is, you know, the Pasuk does still have the word Ha'achron. So a lot of Mephoshim point out the word Ha'achron does not necessarily have to mean the last one. It can mean the next one. So therefore, this is the next one, the second one, but there's still another one to come after that. In this week's parasha, you have something like that, because you have. In this week's parasha, Moshe is asking Hashem, I need signs to sort of show the Jewish people that you send me. So Hashem gives him the sign first with his hand with Tzaraf, and then that'll throw down a stick, and it'll become a snake. And the Eibishter tells him, Im lo yishmu l'kol ha'os ha'rishon, if they don't listen to the first os, v'haminu l'kol ha'os ha'achron, then they'll listen to the achron. Now the achron, they also doesn't mean the last one, because the snake one is not the last one. Then Hashem tells him, if they still don't believe, then you'll take water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and it'll turn into blood. So we see very clearly there that Ha'achron doesn't mean the last one, it means the next one. There is, in fact, a vort on that, I think, from the Chassam Sofer, I think, that ties it together with what we're saying about Avihu Abayis as Ha'achron. The vort is something like this. Im lo yishmu l'koil ha'ois ha'rishon, if the Jewish people do not listen to the first ois, to the fact that the first Beis Hamikdash and doesn't last, they have minu, what they will believe, l'koil ha'ois ha'achron, they will believe by hearing you say the word achron over here, and that the word achron does not mean the last final one, but rather the next one. Based on that, they will be able to believe that gadol yia b'ayis hazeh ha'achron also does not mean the last one, it means the next one, and there's still another one yet to come after that, the Mehed of Yemen. Fine. The Gemara goes on to talk about, having talked about the height of the Beis Hamikdash and all, the Gemara goes on to discuss dinim about, suppose you have a shul that needs to be reconstructed. So the Gemara talks about dinim in that regard. You're not allowed to tear down the shul unless you have another shul available. Because otherwise, the Gemara points out, the people will be pashaya, they may get careless, and then they're not going to have a shul to daven in at all. So the Gemara goes...
That they will get...
They'll get careless. They'll get careless, and they won't bother. Careless. Mm-hmm. So then the Gemara goes through various dinim about that, and eventually the Gemara discusses as follows. We find that when Hurdus renovated the second Beis Hamikdash about 100 years before it was destroyed, then he's renovating it, and they obviously couldn't have a second Beis Hamikdash in its place, so how was he allowed to renovate it? So the Gemara gives a couple of answers, one of them being that because the structure of the Beis Hamikdash was in fact very unstable by that point, the Gemara explains that if the shul is in fact about to collapse, then you are allowed to tear it down and only then build the new one because you don't want it to collapse. So here with the Beis Hamikdash, it would have been the second thing. By the time Hurdus comes around, the second Beis Hamikdash is well over 300 years old, and it's been through quite a lot. It went through all the wars with the Hashmonaim and the Greeks and all kinds of other things like that. The Romans breaking into it a couple of times. So it was badly overdue for renovations. That's one answer the Gemara gives. And another answer is Hurdus being a king, he's going to make sure it happens no matter what. Omer Malka Okar Torah, the Gemara phrases it. If a king says to uproot a mountain, then the mountain's going to be uprooted. So we don't have to worry there's going to be Pshia or that he'll run out of resources or whatever. So that leads the Gemara into telling the story of how Hurdus came to renovate the second Beis Hamikdash in the first place. Now we have to realize if anybody over here has ever been on any of those tours in Eretz Yisrael of the various buildings, Hurdus was a great builder. He loved building all over Eretz Yisrael. But he was also a horrible, disgusting kind of person, even to his own family, and very paranoid. He had several members of his family, even actually the children of his own, executed because he thought they were plotting against him. So, and then here in the Gemara, we're also going to see that he was Bichlal not a nice guy. But he loved to build. But how come you have buildings of his all over Eretz Yisrael? But how comes it particularly that he's rebuilding the Beis Mikdash? So the Gemara tells the story.
He actually built himself?
Well, we don't mean he's personally going and laying bricks, but we mean, in other words, that he's the one who gave the orders and financed it and all that. Yeah, so how does it come about? So the Gemara says, Hudus Abdu de Beis Hashmonoi Haba. He was a slave of the family of the Hashmonoim. What had happened actually was, a few decades before that, Yochanan Kohen Gadol had conquered Edom, the south of Eretz Yisrael, in the area where the Edomim live, and forced them to become Gerim. Maybe forced them to become Gerim, maybe it means based on our Gemara, it seems that basically what he did is he forced them to become Avodim Knanim, and of course Avodim Knanim have to accept on themselves certain mitzvahs. So now, a few decades later, a couple of generations later, Hurdus came from from one of these families. Yeah, so they came from Adam, yeah. In fact, you know, we always talk about the Romans, or the Romans we talk about are connected with Edom, and there are a number of Mephoshim. I think the Eben Ezra in particular says that's based on this, because in Hurdus' times is when the Jewish people really became very, very badly subjected to Rome, and therefore, so the Gemara is calling it Edom, even though the Romans themselves are not from the same ethnicity as Hurdus, but nevertheless, it's all connected. The Abba Benel, I think, actually says that. Okay, anyway. So, Nosen Enam Ba'osa Tinoikos. He put his eyes on a certain young lady from the Hashmonoim. He wanted to marry her. But how is he going to? He's an Eved, and she's a princess from the Hashmonoim. Yoim Chad Shomahu Gavra Baskola. One day, that man heard a Baskol, to have a Ka'omra that was announcing, Kol Avda, the Morid Hashta, any slave that rebels against his masters now, Matzlach will be successful. So he realized that's meant for him. Kom Katlinu L'chulam Marvose. So he went and killed all of his masters. I mean, it was a long process. You look in Josephus' histories, he has, the whole thing took decades, but one after another, the various remaining members of the Hashmonoi family were killed. The Shire of Oisit Tinokas, he left over that young lady that he wanted to marry. She realized that he had designs on her, that he wants to marry her. She went up onto the roof, the Roma Kola, and she yelled out and called out the Omra, Kol man de Yesiv Yemam in the base Hashmonoi Kasina. Anybody who ever says in the future and comes and says that I'm descended from the family of the Hashmonoim, Avdahu is in fact an Eved. It will be Hudus and his descendants who are going to falsely claim that they're related to the Hashmonoim. Because the only one that's left from them is that girl, myself. And that girl is now going to fall off, and is now going to fall off the roof. And sure enough, she fell off the roof. How is she allowed to commit suicide? You could say because she's going to be forced into a marriage with Hudus, which is also... anyway, the bottom line is, that's how it was, and we learned in Kedushin that, in fact, a couple of hundred years later, there was a fellow in the time of Shmuel and Rabbi Yehuda who claimed that he was from the Hashmonoim, and they declared that he was an Eved. There is actually something from, I think, from Sodik Akoy in Milublin that says maybe not to say that there are no living descendants of the Hashmonoim anymore. He says there are, but they never publicize themselves. They dropped the name Hashmonoim and blended in among the Jews. So we still have, he says, there are in fact still Jews descended from the Hashmonoim, real Jews, not Avodim, but we don't know who they are. Of the known ones, anyone who comes along and claims that I'm from the known ones is really an Eved, she's saying. She's the only one left, and as a matter of fact, by the way, Josephus actually has in his histories, he has that Hurdus did marry a girl from the Hashmonoim and had a couple of kids with her. That would be, in other words, based on our Gemara, we understand that was propaganda that Hurdus put out, and Josephus bought it. He didn't know the truth that the Gemara is saying over here, that she actually died and was Mestama. What happened was Hodas took some other girl and passed her off as a Hashmonoi. It's not like they had pictures and photo IDs and whatnot in those days to be able to sell. Also not like anybody was going to go up publicly against him and say that he doesn't know what he's talking about, because they'd find themselves dead pretty soon anyway. So the Gemara continues, why it is, by the way, that the Hashmonaim were wiped out, famously the Ramban says that they deserved it because they took the kingship in the first place, and the kingship is only, the Ramban says on the Pesukim in Parashat Vayechi, that Yaakov had promised the kingship to Shevet Yehuda, and no other Shevet is supposed to take it, and the Hashmonaim are not from Shevet Yehuda, they're Koyanim, so they had no business taking the kingship, and therefore he says eventually that's why they got wiped out. Many other Rishonim disagree with that, and say no, there were valid reasons for them to take the kingship. We do find that the later Hashmonaim became Tzedukim, and that would be a different reason why they were exterminated. In any case, the Gemara continues. Hurdus took this girl's body and preserved it in honey for 7 years. What was the purpose of preserving it in honey? Some say that he had relations with the body during those 7 years, and therefore he wanted to keep it fresh, and some say he did not. In fact, there's a different Gemara, I think, in Yevamos, that refers to a person doing that, having relations with a dead body, and necrophilia, they call it in English. The Gemara calls it Maiser Hurdus, based on this Gemara over here, that there's a possibility that Hurdus was actually so depraved as to do that. Manda, I'm a baal, I hold the opinion that he actually had relations with the body is hadatamna. The reason he preserved, at least suhali yitzri, is in order to appease his yetzahara. That this way he should be able to think to himself, I wasn't able to have her in life, but at least in death. Lamanda, I'm a loy baal, according to the opinion that he didn't. Lomale the bamad hochi. Why would he do that? Why would he preserve her in honey? Hadatamna, kheka de nipple clay shame, de nosiv bas malka. This way he can spread rumors that he married a princess and now he's preserving her body, or de nomu bas malach nosav, or the equivalent, as in the printed Gemara, that people will say that he married a princess. Marsha, by the way, points out, you know, had he been able to marry her, then he would actually be freed, because actually there's a din like that. A master marries his shifcha, or vice versa, a mistress in this case. She would be his sole remaining owner. Who marries him, he'd automatically become free. So that was a reason. He wanted to remove the taint of avdus from himself, and therefore he wanted to marry her, but she didn't want to go along with it, and therefore, as we said, she jumped off the roof. So we'll continue the story tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. Or about what happened and how this led eventually, how one thing led to another, to who just renovating the Beis Hamikdash.
He's still a murderer.
He's still a murderer. Yeah, like I say, he was not a nice guy, to put it mildly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Geula Yud Ches Tevis. So we're very close to the Geula, therefore every Yid has to get accustomed to Geula and put himself into a situation and into a mentality of Geula. That means, in other words, a person transforms his individual day into a day of individual Geula and turning his individual place into Eretz Yisrael, Machta Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, the Rebbe says, a person does his Avodah at this moment and at this time with Tachlos HaShlemus and Machshava Dibra Maisa. And then the Rebbe goes on to say, "Benegel Poyel publicize in every place the Hurrah, this Hurrah, this Machzedek, Machta Eretz Yisrael, and continue on the following days until Mashiach Tzidkenu comes, and then we'll be able to actually bring, then we'll be able to continue with that Avodah in Eretz Yisrael Kipshuta, aside from the fact that it also says that Eretz Yisrael will spread out into all the other lands." Continuing with Halachas of Netilas Yadayim. So we were talking about that a person needs to wash in the morning, and what happens if he doesn't have the right kind of water, and what happens if he doesn't have a naphtha available, etc. So this is what we're talking about in principle. If a person was sleeping dressed and he doesn't, strictly speaking, need to, in Madur Basra, the Alta Rebbe pointed out, it doesn't matter what Pikabola, you have to wash Nego Basra regardless. If a person was sleeping in his clothes, so he didn't touch any covered part of his body.
So he didn't touch his
clothes. Then in theory, Allah, he wouldn't need to wash Nego Basra unless he's going to daven, but the Alta Rebbe mentioned Madur Basra, he needs to anyway, Al Pikabola. So now, Chazal say that when a person sleeps 60 breaths at night, which we usually understand to be, we usually take that to be a half hour, although there are different posts can talk about different amounts over here. Anyway, that then his neshama leaves him, and therefore Ruach HaTumah comes and rests on him. And as soon as he wakes up, that Ruach HaTumah leaves his whole body except for his hands. For that, he needs to wash on them three times alternately. So you don't do three times in a row like you do for Netilas Yadayim for bread. You alternate back and forth between the hands three times, and then that removes that Ruach HaTumah. Before that, the Gemara says, a person should not be touching his mouth, because that could make him mute, or his eye, or his ears, because he might become deaf, or his eyes, he might become blind, or his nose, or his mouth, so it doesn't cause him a bad odor from his nose or his mouth. Also before that, he shouldn't be touching a place on his body from which bloodletting was done, or any food or drink, so he's not metame then. So he's not metame then with the Ruach HaTumah that remains on his hands before Negel Vatzer. I think on the Gemara says a practical thing, basically that when a person wakes up in the morning, his hands may well be dirty with germs and whatnot, and he puts them to his eyes or his ears, partial begashmias, he may cause infections over there, but generally we understand that as being more of a ruchnistic type of thing.